Now that the election has been decided, we thought it might be safe to take a look back at the unexpected words that have helped make the presidential campaign more, should I say, colorful or charged, like rigged or big league. And who better to help us sift through it all than Ben Zimmer, the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to our show.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
And if anyone wants to bring up or ask any particular term that has made this election season more memorable, give us a call, 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate, or you can find us on Facebook as well. Ben, are you relieved that the campaign ended, or did you enjoy the unusual flurry of words that got bandied back and forth, linguistically speaking?
Well, there was certainly no end of sort of fascinating language to look at. And that's pretty true of any presidential campaign season, but especially this one. And we have Donald Trump primarily to thank for that. You never knew what was going to come out of his mouth. It was often very unexpected, very often unscripted. Sometimes it would appear over social media or in a stump speech in a way that, you know, would catch people off guard, and people would be reacting to a turn of phrase or even just a particular word that he used and talking about, well, what did he mean by that? And so there was a lot to deal with.
Are you looking forward to the next 4.5 years? Because you'll have a lot more of that sort of stuff from the president.
Well, I guess like stand-up comedians will have lots of material to deal with. Language observers will also have a lot to deal with. I wouldn't say I'm necessarily looking forward to that, but yeah, certainly there will be no end of material to talk about when it comes to political language.
Just last night, Van Jones on CNN was talking about how this is a white lash. Did he invent that term?
You know, I looked into that because that was interesting. Yeah, that was when it became clear that that Trump would be the winner. And Van Jones on CNN, you know, stated, you know, that he called it a white lash. So, you know, this term for a white backlash, where he's talking about how it was a backlash of, you know, the white working class voters, and looking at that sort of racial component. But, you know, I looked into that and noticed that it was actually used way back to describe the 1968 presidential race of George Wallace when he ran as an independent and ended up winning 5 southern states. An article that came out the following year called it the Wallace White Lash. And so it's interesting, actually, you know, you can see not just with that, some other comparisons we could make to 1968. You know, we had the law and order rhetoric of Trump, which sounded a lot like Nixon from 68. And of course, Nixon had the silent majority, and Trump spoke a lot about the forgotten men and women of our country. That's what he talked about in his convention speech. So very similar to that silent majority idea. And as it turned out, that kind of rhetoric resonated well.
It's interesting to note that some of the phrases were reclaimed by the other side, like Trump's nasty woman and Clinton's deplorables. Those are not the sort of things that I would have expected to resonate so strongly.
Yeah, that's been one of the really fascinating aspects of the campaign season, is how quickly words and phrases, once they get out into the ether, can be quickly recontextualized, resignified, even reclaimed. So we had Hillary Clinton using that memorable phrase, the basket of deplorables, to describe half of Donald Trump supporters as racist, sexist, xenophobic, and so forth. And within hours of that speech being sort of made public, Trump and his supporters had embraced that label and called themselves deplorables proudly. And, you know, it would show up in Trump rallies and so forth. And it was a way of highlighting what they saw as Hillary Clinton's haughty disdain for a large portion of the electorate. And again, it sort of fed into the feelings of resentment or being, you know, left out of the political process or being looked down upon by the elites. So she played right into that rhetoric by using that term. And so her own words were used against her. In a similar way, nasty woman, when that came out of Trump's mouth in the third debate, was used against him very quickly among Clinton supporters, who put it on T-shirts and so forth and proudly proclaimed themselves as, you know, nasty women.
Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders gave us a couple of words, rigged, both of them used that, and huge, which became a laugh line for comedians.
Well, with Huge, it just so happens, of course, that, you know, we had this unusual situation of two presidential candidates with New York accents of the sort of the traditional style. And so their pronunciation of Huge, dropping the H as huge, that both Sanders and Trump showed, you know, it was a part of their charm, actually, as people saw it. You know, they were authentically presenting themselves using this, you know, dialect feature.
Then they spelt it Y-U-G-E,
right,
instead of
exactly.
H-U-G-E.
Yeah. So, you know, people of from New York who grew up around that time drop that H in words like huge, human, humor, and so forth. You don't hear it so much these days.
David from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just heard you refer, or we just heard you refer to the phrase, or the term rigged, and I think it goes in through an interesting sort of triple incarnation, because first, of course, it was Elizabeth Warren going around denouncing the economic system as rigged. The system is rigged, if you remember that phrase of hers, meaning that the economy was rigged in the way that to prevent the little guy from getting forward. Then Bernie Sanders took it over in a different sense to mean that the primary system was designed to exclude smaller candidates like himself. In particular, superdelegates were being used so that the system was rigged against his candidacy. And finally,
Trump was using it.
Finally, Trump used it in a third sense, which is to say that dirty tricks were being performed against him, that there was going to be a large-scale cheating. And
do you think he's at all embarrassed by the end result after he claimed that?
Right.
Because it suggested that he didn't think he was going to win and that the system was rigged against him.
Right. And, I mean, he was railing against a rigged system, which he now inherits. But the caller perceptively points out that it was used in all these various ways. The idea of the economic situation being rigged was certainly promoted by Bernie Sanders, and then Hillary Clinton also ended up adopting that rhetoric because of Sanders, and then Trump echoed that as well. But of course, what he called rigged tended to be the political process. First, he thought that the Republican convention was going to be rigged until he won the nomination, and then he thought that the general election would be rigged until he won that. So it was kind of an all-purpose term this election cycle to talk about whatever forces you might see as being arrayed against a candidate or, you know, people in general, working class people, middle class people.
Donald Trump was also fond of drain the swamp, which Nancy Pelosi, Donald Rumsfeld, and the Bush administration have also used. Would they all be surprised at what the term actually refers to?
Well, I mean, it drained the swamp. You know, you can find examples of that in populist or progressive or even socialist rhetoric going back to the early 20th century. And it tends to have this idea about the swamp that Washington, D.C. was supposedly built on, and that it ends up becoming a kind of a metaphor for getting rid of the corruption of D.C. And so it's been a flexible kind of metaphor, you know, with a long history to it. Trump ended up adopting it because his campaign wanted him to late in, you know, just the last couple of weeks of his campaign. He originally seemed like he wasn't very interested in using it, but then he noticed that it was that the crowds were reacting very strongly to it. At first, he's called it corny, but then he heard the crowds, you know, chanting, drain the swamp, and saw that it was working for him. He compared himself to Frank Sinatra, who didn't like the song My Way, but realized, you know, the crowds liked it. So it was another example of how, you know, that was a particular catchphrase in this case. It didn't come from him, but he embraced it once he saw how it worked with the crowd.
It is interesting to note which of the phrases got picked up by the crowds.
Yeah.
Not just that, lock her up,
yes.
Build the wall.
Yeah, those are all handy chanting phrases, three words, each one a monosyllable. That's, you know, easy to chant. When Drain the Swamp came about, that was certainly more palatable than something like Lock Her Up, which was this very fiery rhetoric against Hillary Clinton.
Michael from the East Village, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I heard a lot of journalists on the news channels using the terms double down, drill down. Hillary is drilling down her policies on Trump and doubling down on his economic policy. I guess it's sort of these phrases that I substitute with the simple word verb emphasize.
We talk about the candidates finding certain catchphrases, but I think Michael's point is that the media also finds certain catchphrases that they just go back to again.
Absolutely,
and again.
Yeah. And yeah, double down and drill down are both excellent examples of expressions that the pundits seize upon, and then it seems like everyone's using it. And actually, double down, 4 years ago, people were using that as well. You know, during that election cycle, it certainly was quite useful to use that term double down when it came to Trump. This is a metaphor, again, that comes out of card playing, from playing blackjack. But the idea of like sticking to a position, even if it's very unpopular, doubling down on that position is one that fit Trump quite well. And so it's no surprise it was used again and again to refer to him.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, who is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about the language of the recent presidential campaign, just ended yesterday, although I suspect lots of new words will be popping up all along. Vincent from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks, Leonard, for taking my call. I just wanted to see what Ben had to say about a word that's kind of been recently popping up, especially on the internet, cuck, C-U-C-K.
Yeah, that's one that we can thank the alt-right for popularizing.
Now, alt-right suddenly is a phrase that we hear a lot of. Yeah. Has that been around for a while?
It's been dated back to actually 2008. Alt-right, of course, as a shortened form of alternative right, is this label that's been used for a kind of an umbrella term for a whole bunch of groups that proliferated online, very often having white supremacist or white nationalist points of view, and talking in extreme ways about race and about immigration, and about Republicans who were seen as not strong enough on these issues, who were called cucks, and that's short for cuckold, and it's actually comes out of a term that's used in porn, actually. So again, very very inflammatory type of term that was pretty much designed to get people upset in the way that it was being used. And so, saw it a lot among internet trolls or others who were really trying to get a reaction out of people.
Why do you think so many people heard Big League, which Trump says quite a bit, as Big Lee?
Yeah, well, that was one that people talked about a lot, especially during the debates. This is one of Trump's favorite terms. He's been using Big League, L-E-A-G-U-E, as this unusual kind of adverb for quite a while. I found examples of him using it all the way back to the early 1990s. He used it on the first episode of The Apprentice when he did a voiceover and saying, you know, he lost billions, but he came back Big League. But because it always comes at the end of a sentence after a verb phrase, sometimes that final g sound of the G doesn't get fully released. And so if you just hear Big League without the release, it's easy to misinterpret that as Bigly, B-I-G-L-Y. And a lot of people were confused by that during the debates. In fact, Donald Trump Bigly was one of the most frequently looked up Google searches during the debates.
Locker room talk became a phrase that got used a lot. Now, that's been around a long time and usually used in the same way it was used here. But you rarely hear it in the context of a presidential election.
Well, this is one of the many ways that this campaign was unprecedented when we had the Access Hollywood tape revealed just about a month ago, when people thought that might actually spell the end for the Trump campaign.
And there were so many ends to the Trump campaign over the years.
Exactly. But when that was revealed and the rather vile things that Trump was caught on tape saying about women, it was dismissed as locker room talk or locker room banter as a way of just, saying this is just the way that men talk. A lot of men disagreed that that's not actually the way that you talk in locker rooms. But it spoke to, again, issues of masculinity as well, and Trump always kind of presenting himself in this kind of macho tough guy demeanor, and that he was able to just sort of say don't pay attention to what I was saying, that's just guys talking.
Does the use of an article like the, as in the African Americans, change the meaning of the term?
Well, that was something that people noticed that Trump was doing a lot in cases where the word the seemed to be unnecessary. So he'd say the African Americans, the Latinos, rather than simply just talking about African Americans and Latinos. Linguists were actually writing about this at the time and sort of trying to parse what was going on with that use of the word the, where it seemed to take a group like African Americans and create a kind of undifferentiated mass out of them. So it's a kind of a distancing, or you might say an othering effect that happens just from a rather subtle use of that word, the. But it was a way perhaps that he kind of, again, connected with his base of white working class voters.
He also said the inner cities. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting to note that except for the word deplorables, most of the words and terms that made the headlines were from Donald Trump or his supporters. Was Hillary Clinton's use of the language less colorful, kind of boring?
In some ways, yes. I mean, again, it's hard to compare with a showman like Donald Trump who uses colorful language to his advantage. And Hillary Clinton had a much more orthodox conventional campaign, and that was reflected in the words that she used as well. Very often these words were sort of heavily tested, and sometimes it seemed like a committee had come up with a certain, you know, catchphrases that she wanted to use. From the beginning last year when she announced her candidacy and she was talking about everyday Americans, for instance, she was going to be the candidate of everyday Americans. It turns out we learned from WikiLeaks and the Podesta emails that she didn't much care for that term, and they ended up dropping it quickly. And in fact, when the Podesta email was released, where he was saying that Hillary Clinton is beginning to hate everyday Americans, he didn't put that in quotation marks. So, of course, Drudge Report and the other like-minded sites ran with that and said, Hillary Clinton hates everyday Americans.
David from New Rochelle, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing? Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm very excited to be on the air.
And what do you want to talk about?
I'm calling because your conversation reminds me of a World War II survivor, an author, Victor Kempler. He wrote a book, Lingua Terri Imperii. It talks about the transformation of language during World War II, normalizing and creating euphemisms with words, fanatical, instinct, spontaneous, all in German, becoming and having new meanings. Something today that I think about, what does it mean to be American, and all of these other words that Mr. Trump has been using.
Not just Mr. Trump. Ann Coulter had just gotten to hot water for a suggestion she made about people's forebears in the United States.
Right, where she said that Trump would be winning among people whose grandparents are born in the U.S., when, of course, that would exclude Donald Trump himself. The very idea of being American, what does it mean to be American, these sort of core concepts which are very nebulous but can be exploited for political advantage, and certainly we saw that with the campaign where those become kind of flashpoints for, you know, sometimes nationalist rhetoric, very often populist rhetoric, and trying to appeal to people through that kind of language.
We have about 30 seconds left, but have I left any out? Braggadocious.
Braggadocious is interesting. With, you know, Trump used that in both the primary debate and against Clinton, and people pounced on him for making up the word, which he didn't. It's been in use since, you know, the 19th century as an adjective form of braggadocio. I think the fact that he tends to use much simpler language when he calls out a word like braggadocious, it stands out even more because he's favored such, you know, blunt talk with very sort of simple vocabulary so much.
Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Will you be writing articles about this over the next few years?
No doubt. No doubt.
Thank you so much for being on our show again. We always love having you here.
Always a pleasure.